Sir, can you hear me clearly?
Yes, sir.
So I have to tell you, this is one of the best video screen receptions we've had. You're a very clear image on our end, and we want to make sure that we can hear each other clearly.
Yes, I can hear you. It's a good video on our side.
Fantastic. Well, good morning.
Good morning, sir.
Can you state your full name and ABC number for the record?
Joseph Padilla Baldonado, 092563.
Thank you, sir. You're appearing before the Arizona Board of Executive Clemency for a 31412B parole hearing to consider parole to your next consecutive sentence or absolute discharge. I would like to introduce you to the members of the board conducting the hearing with you today. If you can see on your video conference screen, I'll begin with me because I'm the individual sitting closest to you from your perspective. My name is Louis Quinones. I'll be serving as the panel lead or conductor for this hearing. Next to me is the Honorable Mr. David Neal. At the center of the bench is our esteemed board chairman, Dr. C.T. Wright. Although he may not be attending the entire hearing, he has other duties as our board chairman, and he may not be able to get through this hearing in time, so if he leaves, he will not be a voting member. After him is the Honorable Ms. Gail Rittenhouse, and at the opposite side of the bench is the Honorable Mr. Michael Johnson. I'll begin this hearing with the following summary. Mr. Joseph Baldonado is 44 years old. Is that correct, sir?
Yes, sir.
You are certified eligible by the Department of Corrections for 31412B parole to your next consecutive sentence or absolute discharge. You are currently serving a life sentence for murder of the first degree. The crime occurred on or about May 11, 1991. You were approximately 17 years old at the time of the incident offense. You were found guilty by jury trial on June 19, 1992, then sentenced on July 20, 1992. You are pending an additional five-year prison sentence for promoting prison contraband. You've been parole eligible since June 23, 2016. According to my research, you had no prior felony convictions in the state of Arizona, but an extensive history in the juvenile justice system. Is that correct, sir?
That is correct.
Thank you. I will read a short summary of the offense in question. Of course, we'll give you an opportunity to discuss the case in your own words, but the summary is that on May 10, 1991, you murdered Michael Bingham that night. You and several friends went party hopping, drinking beer at every stop, and using LSD. During the early morning hours, the group left the area of 16th Street and McDowell in Phoenix with you sitting in the front passenger seat. While approaching the 16th Street ramp on Interstate 10, you felt that a truck driven by a victim cut in front of your vehicle. The driver and you were irate, and you directed the driver to catch up with the victim's truck. When the driver pulled even with the truck, or your driver, you opened the window, pulled out a .22 caliber semi-automatic pistol, fired four shots into the cab of the victim's truck. The fatal shot, fired by you, struck the victim in the head, and his truck crashed. According to the report, you laughed when you realized you hit your target, commenting that you had shot and killed the victim. A jury found you guilty of murder in the first degree. According to Ames, you have completed extensive programming in the Arizona Department of Corrections. This is not a regular parole hearing, but you do have a very detailed release plan, including support from family and, I believe, the Arizona Justice Project.
Yes.
You've had moderate discipline in ABC between 1993 and 2003, with your last major for drug possession in 2003. But to your credit, that seems to be about 15 years ago now. So am I correct that you have not had any major discipline in 15 years?
That is correct, sir.
Thank you. This is your third hearing before this board. You have numerous numerous letters of support in your parole packet. According to my scouring of a very large parole packet, I did not see any letters from victims' representatives. This is not to say that there are not victims, but we don't have any letters this time, or individuals in this hearing room representing the victims. We have a letter from the Maricopa County Attorney's Office dated June 5th, 2018, opposing your parole. And again, it should be, well, if I didn't say it already, you have quite a few supporters in the hearing room today. Before I go any further, is there an attorney that will be representing Mr. Baldonado? Would you like to approach the front of the hearing room? Thank you, ma'am. And at this point, I will ask, do you wish to speak on behalf of Mr. Baldonado? Do you prefer that we speak with him first and you follow up, or do you have an order?
Whichever order you would prefer. I have three kind of brief points to make. We have Dr. Leslie White Croft, who will
speak. Please state your name.
Oh, I'm sorry. That's my bad, sir.
Lindsay Herf, Director of the Arizona Justice Project. And then we have, I believe, three family members. A large group of supporters, but only three. Mr. Baldonado's wife, his father, and his niece.
Well, I will leave it to your legal team as to whether or not you want us to speak to him first or if you wish to make an opening statement.
Why don't you go ahead and speak to him, and then we'll have our group speak.
Thank you, ma'am. I appreciate that. Okay, again, Mr. Baldonado, this is your first time before at least some of the members of this board. If I'm not mistaken, we have two board members that were not appointed since last we spoke. So again, this is an opportunity for the board to get to know you, to revisit the case. Can you tell us, in your own words, about the offense that resulted in your incarceration? Thank you, sir.
Well, the night of this tragic incident, me and some friends went out drinking, went to house parties, started doing drugs. I mean, this is a real just brief scenario of what just happened. It was 2 in the morning when we decided to go ahead and go home, and I was coming out the freeway. Mr. Bingham cut us off. I got upset. And I asked my co-defendant to catch up to him. And I shot him in the head. And from there, it's just been a nightmare for me.
Mr. Baldonado, if you could, because this is a cycle that we see many times sitting on this board, and we take each of these cases individually. So we look at the totality of this case. But tell me a little bit about the culture. Well, tell me a little bit about, were you part of a street gang at the time, sir?
No, sir, not in no gang.
No, but when this crime was committed, were you part of a gang?
No, sir.
Well, I guess then I'll ask generally, tell me about the culture of violence that you were living in. Is the backstory for you and the sort of lifestyle that led to this crime.
Well, I'm not sure if there's a backstory that leads to this crime, but as a youngster growing up, I just got into many fights. Some happened to be with gang members, and it seemed like it was a continuing pattern. Let's say if I was to get the upper end of the fight, the next member of that group would want to challenge me, and it was just a continuing pattern. So I even tried to leave. I was in Trevor Brown High School. I tried to transfer to Thomason to get away from that type of environment, and it seemed to just struggle when I was in Thomason. But it all comes down to just making poor choices, hanging around the wrong people. My value system, I instill this thinking out of the values of my family. I've paid more attention to my friends. That's the biggest mistake ever. And I was just immature, irresponsible, and stubborn at that time as a juvenile.
Sir, I want to be clear on this. I mean, each of the board members votes individually. We don't discuss these cases before we come into the hearing room. This certainly isn't a criminal trial. Some of the questions I'm going to ask are to get an understanding of this case. I did have a little bit of difficulty finding those words. I didn't mean to assume that you were in a street gang. I guess what I was getting at was maybe more than anything the culture of violence. So you said that there was a lot of fights and that sort of thing when you were growing up. Were the presence of firearms routine? Were a lot of people armed?
No, most of my fights occurred during the school, during the school sessions, and that's where all the interaction with other students, and that's where just the fights occurred. But on this night, my co-defendant usually carries a gun with us in the car, or I should say, have a gun in the car just for protection, never the thought of using the gun, but just to hopefully scare in case anything did come up. But that did not happen that night, sir.
Had you seen friends and associates with guns before, or is this the only gun? I don't mean just that night. I mean, I guess what I'm getting at, were people routinely carrying guns back then?
Yes, back then it seemed there was a trend where everyone had at least a knife or something of protection. And unfortunately, we had the gun. But yes, that was the pattern that was happening at that time where now that I see nowadays, it's everybody has a gun and it's crazy up here.
I will say from my own experience, it seemed around that time that gun violence was starting its climb out in the street here in Phoenix. I was familiar with that sort of arc, if you will. I think this isn't about me, but I remember beginning around my junior high years in South Phoenix where it didn't seem that guns were so prevalent. There were certainly fights, but the gun violence seemed to be really picking up in the late 80s and early 90s. So that's why I'm trying to get a little bit of understanding of the world that you were living in at that time, without excuses, but just the reality. How was it, in your mind, possible that this event could lead to you shooting another individual?
That's a good question, and you know, being under the influence of drugs at that time, and I hate to say that and use it as an excuse, but that's what happened. If I was under my right state of mind, this would have never happened. I'm not that type of person. A person that would laugh after killing a human being, and that's just a person not in the right mind. And then that's not normal. And that's. I hope I made sense and to try to clarify what you're trying to.
Well, thank you, Mr. Baldwin. I'm certainly not trying to put words in your mouth. It is about trying to get an understanding of that time, your mentality at the age of 17, your associates. Certainly, I'm not trying to back into a corner on this. I think one thing that is a little disturbing in this lifestyle is individuals trying to press each other by acts of violence. So I wasn't sure if it was a credibility thing where people were held in esteem, as we've seen in gang culture. That's why I asked in the beginning. But there's a certain amount of prestige in having been involved in a violent act. So I'm trying to figure out what sort of lifestyle you were living.
Okay. Well, I know for anyone, it doesn't matter what, there's peer pressure. And a person has to learn to stand on their own 2 feet. And at that time, as a juvenile, I was a follower. And I didn't have the courage to be a leader and to be a positive apprentice to let people know, look, let's not do this and let's not do that. I was more of, let's go along with it, and if something was wrong at that time, I didn't want to feel like a weak person in front of everybody and not go along. And that was my problem at that time, is of being influenced and being followed.
What sort of juvenile crimes had you been involved in leading up to this? Because again, you were only 17, correct?
Yes, sir. The ones that I have to remember is, it started off as just petty theft. There was a time like my father had to work 2 jobs, so I hardly got to see him, and he provided us with necessities, and I'm not blaming him for not having anything, but I was a person, when I saw something that I liked, that I would just take it without pain, and those were from the petty thefts. I believe the next was vandalism. That was, had to do with my drinking and acting silly, and I punched a guy's truck's tire with a knife. What purpose that served and what satisfaction I got out of it, I have no idea, but that's under the influence of alcohol. And I knew another was assault. And that was from a fight at a park where a gang member was fighting one of my partners, and he actually shot him in the foot. And when he started running, I went and got a baseball bat and chased him down. And not thinking of my actions and not thinking what damage I could have done to the person, I hit him in the head and started hitting with the bat a couple of times, 2-3 times. And I believe that's it. I believe that's 1 or 2 assaults. I can't remember.
Well, thank you for accounting for that. Let's talk a little bit. I began during the summary stating that it would seem that you've had pretty good discipline in the Department of Corrections for quite some time. There's information that's collected in Ames, and I want to be fair to you. I know that one of your pending charges is for promoting prison contraband. So did you get involved in prison politics when you were young in the prison system?
I wouldn't say I got into prison politics, but being that I came in at a young age, I believe it was 19, in a maximum setting where the politics, that's all it is politics. And I've met many people in my time, people that are in politics, people that are not in politics. So, may I ask, what was your question again?
Oh, I was just asking if you, because you have a conviction for promoting prison contraband, were you involved in prison politics or prison gangs?
No, sir.
What was the contraband that you were convicted for?
I believe it was 4 grams of heroin.
And we understand that drugs continue to be available inside the Department of Corrections, unfortunately, due to smuggling. But were you using heroin at the time?
Yes, sir.
And how long were you involved with using heroin inside DOC?
I mean, it's the moment that I've stepped in the prison system. You know, a lot of has it to do with my self-pity, of realizing that this is the life that I have to live. And I've done it to actually just make it a lot easier for me, which was a bad choice, because there is positive ways to channel my mental state and everything, but it was to cope with numbing my feelings and dealing with where I had to lose her.
So did you stop using heroin?
Yes, sir.
When did that happen, sir?
2003.
So.
And if I may.
Yes, sir. This is your turn.
In 2003, when I got busted for the heroin, that's when I had to do some self-reflection and seeing the disappointment in my parents' face, and it hit me inside. And knowing that I was wrong, they were still there to support me. And I know they wanted to let me, but they didn't, because I knew what I was going through. And after that, that's when I started self-reflecting. Is this who I am? Is this where I want to be? And that's when I decided to make that change. To better myself as a person, so that way I can make it out to see my parents. They're at a time where they're going to need me to help take care of them, so I have to do what's best for my family and now for my wife. And that's the biggest change was self-reflecting, is the same in my life.
Mr. Bellinato, again, I'm asking as one voting board member, this particular issue, I think, can be a little slippery, what we're getting into. And that is, in general, when we speak to people inside the Department of Corrections, especially regarding STGs, there's a lot of denial. So we have a lot of intelligence information about your involvement in STGs. And it would seem, and we'll get into the positive stuff, but did you go through some sort of step-down program or separation?
I've been trying since the program was implemented in 2009. I'm not sure the exact date, but I had submitted an inmate letter to SSU for my participation in the step-down program. And that was 2011, so I've gone through the process, but the reason I'm still here and not able to work my way out of Brahman unit is they believe my life would be in danger if I were to participate in that step-down, because it would put me in with the same people that I am validated with. And I believe it's in my parole packet with this famous expressing that.
Yes, no, I appreciate that. I'm asking to understand where you're at in your rehabilitation and your personal development.
Yeah, I've been trying to participate, but since I cannot participate, all I can do at this time is continue to program and better myself as a person, which I have been. I know there's, with letters, reference letters, I mean, staff does not have to do that, but seeing how I am, interacting how I am, and complying with what needs to be done in here, they've gone out of the way to write these reference letters. I mean, I understand that they have time to see what kind of person I am and to see if I am a person that belongs in here or a person that does not, they had the time to see that, and especially with Mr. Victoria, you know, he believes that I am ready to enter back into society because he does see that change in me as a person.
Well, thank you, sir. You know, I have to ask hard questions today on behalf of the people of Arizona, but I certainly read those letters, and you do have some very powerful support letters, and as I've stated, I don't think you can see it from your perspective, but you have a large number of people here supporting you today.
Well, I understand, sir, and I'd like to answer any questions you might have, and it's difficult for me, but I know this is the process.
Thank you, sir. And, well, let's talk about some of the positive things. You've been off of drugs for a long time. You've had good discipline for, again, what seems to be about 14 or 15 years. You've done a lot of programming. Let's talk about that. Actually, the list is really, really long, but have you received some sort of college programs or certifications since you've been inside the Department of Corrections?
College programming, I believe it's not allowed here, being in a maximum unit, because most textbooks are hardback. So, and that's one of the things that frustrates me as an inmate here in Browning Unit, is I can't work my way out of here to take advantage of such courses like that. But anything that they can offer here, you know, I have participated in and took.
This is a part of the correction system that I'm unfamiliar with, and if you know this, please share it with me. But if this board saw fit to parole you to your next consecutive sentence, would you remain in Browning?
Yes, I will remain in Browning, and the only way I can work my way out of here is to debrief. And to debrief would actually put my life in danger and possibly my family's life in danger. So that's why I have not debriefed, and I've stuck here and done what I had to do and being a positive person in here. And it might help others, because not everybody here is a gay member. There are some here that are STG, but unfortunately, they were out there. They couldn't stand on their own 2 feet, and they followed the group, because if you don't, there's consequences. And I share with them what I learned in class. You know, and I know I share my story and how I am. I'm not a positive, I would say, for most people in here, they don't like me because I'm not with them. I stand on my own 2 feet. There's a few that will accept my decision, and I have my own life. I got my own responsibilities. I got my wife. But most part, you know, most people shy away from me, but I'm okay with that, because their opinion doesn't matter to me. It's my wife's and my family and those that are positive in my life. That's what matters to me.
So I'm just going to ask you a few more questions before opening up. Before opening up for questions from my colleagues, one is, how have you managed to avoid problems for so long in that environment? Because and you already accounted for part of that, and I'm impressed about your independence. You had stated that, and I'll change the words here, but standing on your own 2 feet is probably not very popular in the unit that you're in. So how have you been able to negotiate that? You know, staying out of trouble, avoiding conflicts inside the prison system?
Well, for me, the main thing is not putting myself in that situation. I've been doing time for so long that I can pretty much figure out and see how something is going to go. Now, if I see something that's going to go bad, or I stay away from it, because if I were to intervene and say the same way for whatnot, then I'm in trouble and people here can make it real difficult for me. So that what made it easy for me is I'm a owner. You know, I stay way out of everybody's business. If they don't want to share their lives with me and their positive things that they might have going on with their needs, then I ain't got no problem with that. But, you know, being an owner and staying out of everybody's business is what kept me here. And the thing about me being here is, and I guess it's Houston, they can't put me in a step down because my life is in danger. Now, probably me staying away from these individuals here and not participating in whatever negative act they might do or have planned, that's probably why they will not put me in there, but there's nothing I can do. I'm stuck here. But as long as I focus on myself and keep programming better myself as a person, that's all I can do here, sir.
A little follow-up on that, you've described yourself as a loner, and I understand that, but have you been able to associate with any positive people since you've been inside Browning?
Like I said, there's a couple that got the STG, but they're not gang members. They just happen to get caught up in the web of just associating and talking with them, but not really a gang member. And on the secret and on the hush, she'll talk to me and share their plans and whatnot. But like I said, that's a few. And, you know, but like for the most part, I try. There's not many of those type of people in here. So I do my best to keep my mind focused and busy. And so this place doesn't affect me as being an owner.
This is more of a curiosity, but do you feel that if you were in a different yard, that it would be a more social environment, in a positive social environment?
Most definitely.
I appreciate your answer, and I just have one last question. For some reason, I don't remember this from the last time we've had a hearing. We hear so many cases, Mr. Baldonado, they really do get mixed up. I didn't think that was possible, but once you start hearing a couple thousand cases, you're like, okay, I don't remember. So you said you have a wife. I'm going to ask if she's in the room today. Okay, thank you. When did you develop that relationship? Without getting too personal, I just mean, how old is that relationship?
We've known each other since, she's a family friend, we've known each other from even when I was in the street. We had just lost contact. She used to live in Lock, New Mexico. Now, of course, I was here in Arizona, and we used to go visit, I used to see her. And then we just had a crush at that time, just little things. But once she relocated here and got a job, and she located me, and we just started corresponding, and things just blossomed to what it is today. And I married her because she's a big difference that helped me to better myself as a person.
And again, when did you get married?
In 2008.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you, sir.
If your relationship is holding after that much time in the system, I certainly admire that. I'm going to ask my fellow board members if they have any questions for you, Mr. Baldonado. Yes, sir, Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Baldonado, can you hear me, sir?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So part of my concern is after, you know, reviewing and going over your packet and looking at some of the transcript information is that you did make a statement that back in the day that you were a follower, but it appears more that I wouldn't consider you a follower, but more of a leader, that you made your own decisions to get involved and do the things that you did. And the reason that I'm making reference to that is because it appears that, you know, you're still showing leadership ability, but you're showing it in a different direction. What you're doing now is not being a follower, but you've been more of a leader, and I think you had that ability to do that back then. You just made, you know, different decisions during that period of time. So I'm trying to just understand from you, sir, the life's changed so much. You've spent the majority of your time incarcerated in prison. How do you plan if, you know, this is just to parole you to your next consecutive sentence, but, you know, that's just a short sentence, and, you know, you'll be coming up for parole shortly after that to be released. But how do you plan on continuing this positive leadership type role that you've been doing at this time?
Well, in the past hearings, restitution was a main thing, and it was court ordered for me not to pay until I was released by the court. But since it was suggested, and I started paying my restitution. You know, my wife is busy; she cannot take off her job and to go down to the courthouse and pay restitution. So my plan is to continue to pay a lump sum once a year and until my release, and then still fulfill my duties to pay that restitution once I'm released. And
so
nothing will change.
Mr. Baldonado,
yes, sir.
Maybe I'm not expressing what I'm trying to get an answer from you for clearly. So part of the problem when you were a teenager is that you were drinking alcohol and you were involved in drugs, and it led to some bad decisions. I know that you haven't been involved in drugs, at least allegedly. You haven't been involved in drugs or alcohol in a number of years. How have you, within your own mind and within your own group, decided that if things aren't going right, How do you plan on, or have you given any thought to frustration not taking over where you fall back into doing drugs or fall back into drinking alcohol that really is a part of what led to your incarceration?
Well, the big part is I matured.
Okay.
I was 17 at that time. I'm 44 now. I've learned to channel everything in a positive way. So if I were to deal, if there's an obstacle or roadblock in my way, then there are positive solutions to it. There might be not be a popular solution, but there will be a solution to that problem. And alcohol and drugs is not a part of my life, so I'm confident, and I know because it still exists in here, and there's many opportunities where I could have gotten high, but that's not my life. So it's just the maturity and the responsibility that I've learned since I've been in here that, well, I was still focused in that path of being a positive person.
Okay. So in your parole packet, there's several letters in your packet from personnel of the Department of Correction, people who are employed at the Department of Correction who have had contact with you, who are really stating real positive things about you, about your demeanor, also that they feel that you would basically, you know, make a good person once you were released from prison. But you have this one incident of an inappropriate relationship with the DOC personnel who lost their job. Can you tell me what that was about?
Yes, I believe it was in 2000. I don't remember the exact year, but I was doing an investigation for that improper relationship with that female. But in the conclusion of that investigation, it was not me, and that's why there was no disciplinary infraction on that incident right there. It was just an investigation.
It was something because the records indicate that person lost their job.
Yes, because they ended up determining that it was another individual that was having inappropriate relationships. That's why it's not in my aims as a disciplinary, because I would have been written up for inappropriate behavior with staff.
Okay, so...
So there's an investigation, sir.
Okay, so otherwise, and you correct me if I'm wrong, I'm just trying to understand. So basically, you're saying that it was an inappropriate, there was an investigation of an inappropriate relationship, and as a result of the investigation, it was determined that you were not the person involved.
Yeah, because there was no disciplinary, because when this incident happened, they had locked me down and another individual down until they completed their investigation. And once they completed, they let me back out to the general population without any disciplinary infraction or either, because it was not me.
Okay. So when, and I'm still going backwards, so when this incident occurred that you're currently incarcerated for, you were on intense probation at the time?
No, I was, I believe I was just taking off intense probation, maybe give or take a month.
Uh-huh. Okay. So, have you been taking trades? I think I saw something in the record that you were taking mechanics and different trades, and I actually have a brother that may be in construction that you were looking at possibly when you were released to get involved with.
Yes, sir. Since I've been here, they do offer vocational classes, and I have taken every class that they offer in vocational training, and it's basic knowledge of each trade, which would be construction, masonry, and everything. So I've taken every class because whenever I'm released from prison, I do not have a specific job that I'm going to get, because I'm open to anything that I'm willing to get, whether it's a good job or a poor job, but something to help me to participate with my wife and help out and to help pay off my responsibilities.
Okay. So you weren't, you said that you weren't STG or gang member when you were there. Did you have some association with some of them just because that's the way the culture was in surviving the prison mentality during that period of time?
Yes, and being locked up for so long, I've known people that are gang members, and I know people that are not gang members, and at that time, there was a whole mess that was going on in here, and just because I was speaking to the wrong person, that's what put my life in danger, and that's why I was STG, not actually being a gang member, but because SSU had talked to me about you either got to go to protective custody or we're going to STG, because we cannot release you into general population because your life's in danger. So that's the reason why I got STG and I've been here for so long, just because associating with the wrong people.
Okay. So when this incident occurred back when it actually shooting, there was some discussion about driving through a black neighborhood and shooting someone. That was only a discussion that took place, is that right?
Yes, sir.
So it didn't happen, is that correct?
Yes, sir.
So what changed that? What was the decision not to do that?
Reflecting back at that time, I don't recall exactly of why or why not. It's a stupid thing to say. It was I'm ashamed to even having to even mention this ever happened or it even said. But to go to why it didn't, I can't.
Okay, so Mr. Quinones was talking about a culture of violence back in the day when this was happening when you were in school, and there was a fight that occurred, some other things that actually occurred. If you were, and we're only talking about being paroled to your next consecutive sentence, but at some point you'll be released from prison. So how do you plan to avoid, and if you come in contact with this type of situation, how do you avoid trying to participate in that on the outside? Like, you're doing a good job on the inside. I see, I can go by your records, I see everything that's going on, but it's a different situation on the outside, you know. How do you maintain the same calm you have now, that when you release, you have that same calm?
Well, it's, for me, it's not putting myself in a situation now. It's all about, there's a saying, you know, birds of a feather flock together. I visit myself, I have my wife to focus on, I don't have friends, and to be going partying and to be drinking, and I have my, there's a focus that I'm set, which is my wife and my family, and I distance myself with those friends. I mean, I've been in here for so long. Everybody that I even hung out with, I mean, to me, it's non-existent. I haven't had contact with any of them. I'm moving out to a different area from where all this happened, where friends of mine from back in the days. So for me, it's moving out of the general area of that where I met these people and staying away from those type of people.
Okay, so...
Because I believe that's the trap that violates a lot of people, is they go back to those friends and going back to that neighborhood.
Okay, so that is just a concern, because it appears that, you know, most of the situations, even as a juvenile, that you got involved in, was not a pre-planned thing. It's not something that you just set out and said, you know, this is what we're going to go out and do. It's just, you know, a situation that just occurred. The situation with shooting at the car was not a situation that, you know, even going to the parties and drinking, that you had set out with. You didn't wake up that afternoon and say, let's go do this. It was a situation that just happened, and it's how you responded or reacted to that situation. So my concern or my interest is that, you know, your reaction to a situation or something that came up like that again, whether it was with your friends or family, that you would react to it in the same way that you were reacting to what you're going through while you're in prison now.
Well, I believe communication is the key, you know, and that's one thing, and I'm still working on learning how to communicate coherently. I know what I want to say, but the words just don't come out as, I guess, proper as I would like it to be. But that's what I've learned, is to communicate. Communication can solve a lot of problems. It diffuses a lot of problems. And to get an understanding what the problem is, and to figure out solutions and how to solve that problem.
Okay. All right, Mr. Baldonado. Thank you, sir.
All right, thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Yes, Ms. Winters.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Quinones. Mr. Baldonado, I know you're kind of limited by your environment right now, but what would you do, what did you like to do for fun, or what are your interests?
In being here, my interest before I was got incarcerated before this incident, I was an athletic person. I loved to be involved in sports. It didn't even have to do with sports, it didn't matter what. I was more of a physical person. Being in here, and being locked up for being clean for 27, 28 years, I've been idle in that area. So, but I would like to find interest, and one of the things that I would like to do is photography. And it could be just a hobby, because I see things now that other people don't. It could be just normal, a person staring out the distance, or there are certain things that I can catch that I see that has meaning, and other people will think that it's nothing, you know. So I think that's the high that I have, and I think that's something I would like to do as a hobby once I'm released.
Interesting. Okay. Thank you, sir. Thank you, Mr.
Quinones. Thank you, Ms. Rittenhouse. Mr. Dean?
No, I'm having anything at this time.
Okay, no questions from Mr. Neal. I will follow up just for the sake of discussion. We got several people here that want to speak, so we certainly need to make good management of our time. But that's interesting that you're interested in photography, and I think you'll find, should you ever come out to the community, that the technology has made it much easier to take good photos. There's something called critical moment. I remember this from art class, and you may have a very good eye for that, the way you describe it. So, anyways, what I'm going to do is, if it pleases you, Mr. Baldonado, to turn over the hearing to your attorney, and then we'll begin with this phase.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. And if you could say your name again for the record.
Yes, Lindsay Herf from the Arizona Justice Project. And I do want to thank the board for asking such thorough questions and really, you know, taking time to get to know Mr. Baldonado. So I have three brief points, and I think a lot of what I plan on saying has been kind of fleshed out by the questions. The first is, listening to the hearing from last year, it seemed like there was a little bit of confusion as to what we were here for, but I think it's been made clear today that it is a 412B parole to a consecutive sentence. And then Mr. Baldonado, if the board would grant that, would return to the board for a 412A, and other, you know, conditions and thoughts would be evaluated then. My second point, you know, in terms of the Justice Project's involvement in a case like this, Mr. Baldonado's, comes back to our belief in the potential for rehabilitation, supported by the science and the research in juvenile brain development, in neurological brain studies, in psychiatry and psychology, and looking back at how the brain develops in juveniles. And like what Mr. Johnson was asking about, and pointing out that this wasn't a premeditated crime. This was a hasty act, a decision that was made, snap judgment. There was no thinking about, you know, fully thinking through what was going to happen if they actually responded to being upset that this man cut them off. And as the brain develops and as a person matures, our brain functions in a different way, and we're able to think about things in a more fully and thoughtful manner and consider consequences. And, you know, the legal system has finally caught up with this. And our Supreme Court has acknowledged that, you know, it's cruel and unusual punishment, a violation of the Eighth Amendment, to sentence a juvenile to mandatory life. And that, you know, juveniles should have a meaningful opportunity at release, which is something like this, a parole hearing, an opportunity to, you know, be examined and have an opportunity to, you know, live in the free world again. And another part of the research talks about how juveniles are potentially more capable of rehabilitation, and that's general. There are definitely a lot of adults that also are capable of that. And that brings me to my third point, which is Mr. Baldonado's rehabilitation. You've seen in the unit that he's at, which is very constrictive, that he has been doing since, I believe, 2013, when the department allowed people in that unit to take programming. He's taken every program he can, many more than once. He's engaged in education. Dr. Hoyt Croft will talk about her cognitive behavioral therapy that she's been working on with him, and the advances she has seen in his maturity over the last year and a half. The officers who have all written letters, the people who see him day in, day out, interact with him much more often than we do. And also Lieutenant Reyna's letter explaining the step down. And I spoke with him earlier this week because the letter was dated 2017, and I just wanted to make sure that everything that was stated in the letter is still current today. And you know, he in fact said it is, and further explained that it's not because Mr. Baldonado has been a threat or a disciplinary problem or anything, you know, danger that he poses. It's the exact opposite. It's for his own security, and that he has been certified to participate in the step-down program for a number of years, but the department is not essentially allowing it because of their concern for his safety. So those were my main points. I think you all covered them with his responses very, very well, and so I'd like to turn it over to Dr. Hoyt Croft to talk a little bit about her. Any questions?
Well, I will say that because we have quite a few people, I will ask for
for people to keep their statements succinct.
Yes.
This is not to say that we don't want to hear what everyone has to say, but I don't think long dissertations are going to be necessary. I think we can get to the point. But I think you were a perfect example. I think you hit your points, and it was very meaningful. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Canales?
Yes, sir.
I have one question.
Yes, sir.
Okay. So here's a little bit of concern. So he can't go into the step-down program, and obviously you, with the project, have been working with him. If he's given parole to his next consecutive sentence, and because you say that, according to the Department of Correction, there is some fear for his safety, if he goes into the step-down program, to your knowledge, if he's paroled to his next consecutive sentence, does that impact his current classification in DOC?
I honestly don't know. Mr. Baldonado, I believe Mr. Canales asked a similar question, and Mr. Baldonado said he would remain in Brown Unit.
Okay.
It does affect it?
No, she's saying that
no,
he'll
it
stay.
Doesn't.
He'll stay. Okay,
yeah,
that was, I was just kind of concerned about, you know, and we certainly don't want to do something that's going to put him in more jeopardy. Okay, thank you.
Sure. Yeah, he's essentially in a no man's land right now,
yeah.
So it's difficult. Okay, thank you.
Good morning, board members. I'm Leslie Hoycroft, and I'm figuring 5 minutes, so.
And I don't want to be that restrictive. I'm just saying, I think sometimes in these long hearings, people do start to give long dissertations, and we have to manage time. But thank you.
I understand. Last year, when we met, at least some of you at the clemency board hearing, for Mr. Baldonado, you brought up some important points, and we reviewed your comments, we read the transcripts, and we took those things to heart. And Mr. Wright asked me last year if I had been working with Mr. Baldonado, if he was one of my clients, and if I had been providing therapy to him. I had just met Mr. Baldonado the day before the hearing because I was just doing a social history on him and talking about the drug situation that occurred during the crime. But we took that as a suggestion from Mr. Wright. And so I did start to work with Mr. Baldonado in Florence, where he's housed. I decided to do cognitive behavioral therapy with him, which is a well-known and very effective and historically long form of therapy. And the first thing I had him do was purchase a textbook on cognitive behavioral therapy and also the workbook that goes with it. And I gave him reading assignments for the text, and I gave him written assignments in the workbook, and I met him for blocks of 3-hour periods of time. I started the sessions by having him tell me what the textbook had said, what the reading was about, what he got out of it, and how the information was going to work to help him in terms of his thinking and also his behavior. I had him mail in his written assignments to the Justice Project so I could review them before my next visit with him and see what he had done. These questions were very lengthy, very thought-provoking. They were on things like changing toxic thinking, controlling concentration, recognizing problematic patterns, and then practicing principles of positive living, which I think some of the questions you all asked were referring to that. Now, I knew that Joseph had very little formal education, and he had very little experience with this kind of learning. That's why I was completely surprised with what he brought to the table. I had given him 40 pages of detailed worksheets that required a lot of effort, and I thought, well, this will be what we'll be doing over the next 3 months. Evidently, I didn't tell him that because he came to the meeting and he had done all of them, and he had done all of them thoroughly. He had done all of them well. He was so excited to talk about these new concepts, things that he had never even thought about. And so although he was academically unsophisticated, he was completely up for the process, and really through sheer work and perseverance, he kept coming and coming and coming with these, you know, wonderful questions and thoughts, and just absolutely met the challenge. So since he was so positive about it, I started to challenge him with more and more work, and he did it every time. So we spent over a year on cognitive behavioral therapy so that he could progress in changing his behavior. And I think, Mr. Johnson, one of the things you ask about, well, what if you get out and these negative things happen? That's one of the things that cognitive behavioral therapy helps a person with, is when things go bad, is your thinking going to affect your behavior so that you make them worse? And so, you know, he caught on to that really well. Also, I had him buy this book, Just Mercy. I don't know if any of you have read this book, but it's by Brian Stevenson. And he's a civil rights and social justice advocate. And Lawyer Stevenson writes about disadvantages within the system of being black and being poor, but also how the cases that he's fought have altered his understanding of kindness, hope, dignity, and mercy. And my thought of having Joseph read this, like, why would I have him read it? But I wanted him to see a person who was heroic in every way, a person that he could look at what this gentleman has done in the world and have someone to look up to. And so when he came in, after I had assigned him this book, and he came into our session, there are little, papers everywhere sticking out of the book all over. He opens the book, and I see where he's written in the margins. And I ask him, well, what did you write there? And he completely bought into really looking at what this man was saying and what it meant for him. And I think in the end, he did feel like, oh, this person is a role model for others. So he looked outside himself to someone who was, you know, doing so much good in the world. And I do think he was particularly humbled by what Brian Stevenson said, and that he commented that each of us are more than the worst thing we've ever done. Since Joseph has been in prison, his last 15 years have been exemplary. He stopped using drugs and stopped being involved in anything when he was 29 years old. I researched this. This isn't alleged. He's had many drug tests in the last 15 years. He's never come up positive on any of them. As I'm sure you know, they're random, and he has no way of knowing that. And, you know, in light of the extensive work he's done, I think you can tell he's a very calm person. He talks about being a loner in prison, and I completely understand the efficacy of that, but he's very social otherwise. He's, you know, completely good at making conversation, and I think that when he gets out, as he says, you know, his believe me, the 17-year-olds and the 20-whatever years old, they don't want to hang around with this old man, you know. I think he's going to fall into a life of domestic bliss. I mean, as you said, Mr. Quinones, he's already gotten 10 years, so he'll probably be good by then. So I respectfully ask that you parole Joseph to his next sentence. Do you have any questions? Yes, sir.
It's not really a question, and I'm certainly not here to be Mr. Baldonado's defense counsel either, but I hear you, because when I was asking him about the loner thing, based on what I'm taking in, I don't necessarily see that as him being a loner as much as him surviving in a system where he has to maintain this delicate sort of neutrality. So regardless of how we vote today, I still understand that.
And you're exactly right. I mean, that's a way to survive in there and keep yourself out of trouble. So that's absolutely nail on the head. Any other questions?
Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you.
I think next, Mr. Baldonado's father.
First of all, what do we wish you all?
Your name, sir, pardon.
Oh, my name.
I didn't interrupt you.
My name is Baldonado, Joseph Baldonado's father. First of all, I want to wish you all a very happy Father's Day. Come. And I want to speak on behalf of my son, Joseph Baldonado. He has spent most of his young life in prison. And I'm sure that in communicating with him throughout the years, we have noticed a complete different individual in the way he communicates with us, the way he conducts with other individuals. And I feel very strongly that my son Joseph is ready to undertake the problems and responsibility that he now has. As a father, I am available. It is granted that he be parole, available, that I can help him and encourage him in coming ahead in the near future. Thank you very much, and I appreciate your giving him his parole. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Any questions before we move on?
Happy Father's Day to you too, sir.
Yes, happy Father's Day to you too.
Next, we have Mr. Baldonado's niece.
Good morning.
Good morning. Joseph Baldonado, 19 years old. I'm Joseph's niece, his brother Vaughn's second eldest daughter. I just wanted to talk a little bit about my family and the impact of this incident and what granting my uncle parole would mean. As we've discussed, he's done numerous classes for education. Right now, as I said, I'm 19. I go to college at State with my sister. Last time I saw him, I was maybe 3 or 5. So he's missed a significant amount of my life and my brothers and my cousins, and as well as my other cousins. And they're already having babies, and everyone's growing up, and that would suck to like miss the rest of it. I look forward to him coming out and having discussions about philosophy or other intellectual conversations. I think that'd be great. I myself am a photographer, so when he said that, I was surprised. I'd love to help him out. This incident hasn't just affected the lives of the victim, it's also affected the lives of our family. The way my grandparents had raised their children, as well as their grandchildren and now their great-grandchildren, does not reflect the actions which he had made when he was a teenager. They raised us with love and nourished us and taught us like right from wrong. So I do know that this was an action of like impulse, though I don't have the right to say that. My dad lost his best friend when this happened. My tia and my tia, my uncle and my aunt lost their older brother. And as I said, the other nieces and nephews, we lost someone who could have been a mentor to us. But I know now when he comes out, he's going to be a changed person, as I've heard. And I don't think that he would be consumed in a life of drugs or alcohol that he was before. I think he would be too consumed in catching up with life and trying to learn about each of us and what he's missed, and probably learning about the newest technology, honestly. So I would just like to say thank you, and I hope that we can roll today. Any questions? Sorry.
Young lady.
Yes.
It's fine. I'm 53. I'm saying like young lady now. It's me out a little bit. It's not in my lexicon. You said that you and your sister were going to school out of state. When did you go to school?
We go to school in Notre Dame, Indiana. So, quite a ways away. So,
at Notre Dame?
At St. Mary's Notre Dame, the girls' college.
Oh, okay. Is that like part of, is that next door?
It's across the street.
Yeah, that's what I thought. But that's outstanding, and I think that's a wonderful indication of how your family's doing. So thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you.
Okay, and finally, we have Terry Baldonado, Joseph's wife.
Good morning to all the board. My name is Terry Baldonado. I am Joseph's wife. We knew each other when we were kids, and we got together in our adult years, and we've been married for 11 years now. Here to support him, his parents, Manuel and Rosa Baldonado, his nieces, his nephews, his brother, his sister, and the wonderful Justice Project staff. This is Joseph's third hearing of the board. Since the hearings, he has done everything that the board has advised him to do, stay out of trouble, be discipline-free, continue to participate in any courses that the prison has available to him. Currently, he has been able to obtain a job that they offered him as a porter, and he really loves his job. He is really excited about the job. Every time he calls, he's in excitement telling me what he has done that day or throughout the week. He has, since he has spent 2017 and 2018 working with the cognitive behavioral health therapist, I can see how he thinks differently. In the past, Joseph had told me that some of the prison guards that they work with, they see a difference in Joseph, and they actually give good comments to him. When I've gone to visit, or just in general, when they find out we have hearings, they actually give good feedback of that they hope that everything goes well with the hearing, and they also just tell me what a good person that he is. He complies with every rule. He's not disrespectful to any of them, and that he's just a little great person to work with, and it makes their jobs a lot easier. I've seen a lot of growth from Joseph. He seems to be more grateful for the fact that he has myself and his family to be there for him and support, and that we've done many sacrifices for him, and he sees that and he values that. Not only that, in my personal life, he has been there for me as well. Emotional support with these trying times. There's been times where I just want to give up. I'm trying to put myself through school. There's times where I just want to quit, but he encourages me to move forward and not to quit and to do the right thing. And with that support that he has given me, I have been able to successfully complete that. I'm almost done with my schooling, and a lot of that is help from him, where he's supporting me, to continue that path. I would like to once again thank the board for allowing us to be here today and to hear our pleas. I ask you to please grant Joseph to his next sentence. That's all I have. I just thank you for allowing us to be here today.
Thank you. Any questions? No questions. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Okay, Mr. Baldonado, I believe we're getting close to the end of your hearing. Is there a final statement that you would like you or your attorney to make? And you both may, but is there an order for a final statement that you would like before we go into discussion?
I would just like to thank the Justice Project for presenting my case today, and I'd like to thank the Clemency Board for hearing it. All I'm asking is the opportunity to continue to prove myself, because I still have a consecutive sentence, and nothing is going to change, and I'm still going to do what I've been doing for the past 15 years. And I know it sounds kind of cliche, but I have changed, and I believe my past 15 years kind of, it speaks for itself, just like my poor behavioral past speaks for itself. And just thanks for the board for hearing my case.
Thank you, Mr. Baldonado. And do we have a final statement?
I don't have anything.
Okay, well, okay, Mr. Baldonado, the board will be going into discussion now. It may sound like we're speaking with you directly, but is the board discussing the case amongst itself under the open meeting laws of Arizona? You're reminded that we don't discuss these cases in private. These cases do come up every 6 months to a year, and we don't revisit the case in between. So I'm always pleased with the integrity of this board. We really take the open meeting laws and the rules that guide the board very seriously. So again, the board will be going into discussion. It may sound like we're speaking with you directly, but is the board discussing the case amongst itself? So if you'll just sit tight, so to speak, we'll come back to you shortly with our decision. And thank you for appearing before this board, sir.
All right. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
And just one more thing. I'd like to apologize for putting the board in this position to make a difficult decision on my life.
Thank you, Mr. Baldonado. Again, the board will be going into discussion now. The board is now in discussion. Fellow board members, this is an interesting case, to say the least. And I want to begin by saying, as I think we all do when we have the panel lead, and that is that we don't want to forget that there was a victim of a violent crime. It was a tragedy. There's a family that lost a brother, a son, a father, a friend. These type of cases are particularly disturbing to me. And of course, we hear a lot of different type of disturbing cases, but where peer pressure, the involvement of drugs or alcohol, and lifestyle lead to the senseless death of an innocent, it's hard to reconcile. But I will also say that I look at each of these cases individually. I do look very hard at the cases where individuals were convicted or did the crime prior to the age of 18. We've heard the science many times about the development of the brain, and I've always been a strong believer in that theory, if that's what we can call it. I do believe that people really don't start coming into their maturity to later in their 20s and later in their 30s, depending on the individual, but I certainly have a lot of respect for that science. As always, we have three large considerations as a board, and that is public safety, the concerns of victims, and of course, inmates' rights. I will say that there's a certain wisdom in allowing for some time to pass since Mr. Baldonado has become eligible for parole. He's a young man, but this is his third hearing, and I have to give him a lot of credit considering the situation that he's living in Browning. It's been 2 years since his first hearing, and he's remained out of trouble and probably had to walk a fine line in terms of maintaining his standing in that environment. And I think that's meaningful. So regardless of how this board votes today, I think I'll echo what his therapist had stated. I do believe that Mr. Maldonado is more than the worst thing he's done. I look at where an individual is in the rehabilitation process, and we don't always know what is in the mind or heart of an individual. But I do recognize remorse. I'd like to believe I do. And I think that Mr. Baldonado has done much to redeem himself, especially in these last 15 years in the Department of Corrections.
So that being stated, I am open to granting Mr. Baldonado parole for his next consecutive sentence. And before I turn it over for discussion, I will say, I think it was a point of controversy amongst the board the last time about paroling him to a next consecutive sentence, which was 5 years. But it hasn't changed my position. So I will open it up to the board. Yes, Ms. Whitehouse.
Thank you, Mr. Quinones. I also want to echo that that there is a victim in this crime, and the victim's family is not here today to be able to explain how the victim's death has affected their lives. And just as Mr. Baldonado's family's lives have been affected, that person's life and family's lives were affected. So, I always try to keep that in mind, especially when there's no one here from the victim's side to explain that. So I think we all need to keep that in mind. I agree with you, though. I see that it appears about 15 years ago, Mr. Baldonado made a change in his thinking. And he explained, he told us the moment that he started thinking that. He told us that today. And I'm impressed with the way, I think, the person he became at that moment or has been becoming is the real Mr. Baldonado, not that other guy. I'm impressed with all the work that he's done despite being in a very restrictive environment. And especially I'm impressed by the fact that he's made a point to start paying his restitution already. It's not owed yet until he's released, but he's already started paying that. So I too would be in favor of parole.
Thank you, Ms. Williams. Yes, Mr. Neal.
Pardon me. Maybe not planned, I'm sorry to go forward and went through. A couple of things, and it's not Mr. Baldonado with the science. The point's been made more and more about juveniles and they haven't developed their maturity and they haven't developed until later, but the information that I saw involved 13 people, which is about 4/1 millionth of the population of the country, and who knows how small the portion of the international population. I personally don't put a lot of faith in the science to justify what happened. I do believe, and I know from being not only a victim's advocate, but raising a child that had very, very, very serious mental health development problems. And I do know that the problem with this kind of science is that it's hard to quantify. It's very subjective. And unlike a biology statement or something like that, it's hard to say. And Mr. Baldonado may have been, he may have been very mature at the time he did this compared to his friends in the car. He may have been very juvenile compared to his friends in the car, it's hard to say. But the crime happened, it should have happened. And he's even stating there was really no reason for it. Peer pressure, the gang culture, and the whole nine yards. So, for me, it's like any other number one parole. I'm going to look at what the person has done since then, not what brought him to that point, but what's been going on. And so, but, you know, with that, Mr. Baldonado was very outstanding, and I wasn't there for the last hearing, but it's pretty obvious in the presentation all the way around, he's still making progress. And we have a desire to, you know, rejoin society. And that I think he is truly remorseful for what happened. The other thing, point I'd like to make is, and this is, I'm still a victim's advocate. So 99, I've been dealing with a lot with the victim's advocacy group. as if, you know, for people who have loved one murdered. And in doing that, I see a lot of different reactions from a lot of different people. And so everybody in this room grieves differently than everybody else in this room. And a lot of victims don't like to have to go deal with the past. They can't bring their loved one back. I prefer a letter, some kind of presentation of the victim for their point of view. But I don't discount their point of view because they're not here. And sometimes the victim's family has passed away by the time it comes time for a parole hearing. So we don't know that. But it still brings me back to, the victim was impacted, no doubt about that. Mr. Baldonado's family was impacted, no doubt about that. In the last 27 years or so, it looks like Mr. Baldonado has initially made some poor decisions in prison. But he's made some better decisions, and it's obvious from his record that that conviction in 2003 changed his way of operation, which means he's changed things. So anyway, long-winded as that was, I would be in favor of parole to the next consecutive sentence. Now, I want to say this about this kind of a parole. My understanding from the head of the time comp from DOC is that the life sentence is always going to be there, and so this puts you on other things and can dispense with it, and then he has to go through parole proceedings for the life sentence. And then my issue, one reason I had that explained to me, so I would understand it, is from the victim's point of view, because they don't always understand what's going on with these. But yeah, I would be, at this time, I'd be more than in favor to us, Mr. Baldonado, to the next consecutive sentence. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Neal. Before we continue, I want to thank you for clarifying on that, because that's my understanding as well, and it is something I meant to say in my meandering before handing over the board. But thank you for clarifying that, because I do think that is very important for any victim who might be aware of this hearing, that there's a tremendous amount of accountability should he arrive to that, to his regular parole. Thank you, sir.
I got the impression that Mr. Baldonado understands that going into it. Some inmates don't understand that when they have these kind of proceedings either.
Yes, sir, Mr. Johnson.
I just want to say that, first of all, I want to thank Ms. Harcroft for the cognitive behavior therapy that she's actually provided. It definitely seems to add an improvement to what was going on. I think the last time she had just came in here, I was totally familiar with it, but I do want to acknowledge and thank her for that and the time that she actually took and spent down there. I think that Mr. Baldonado has shown that he's changed his behavior. Like I said earlier, I don't think he was a follower during those times. I think he was more of a leader, but not as a leader as to directing people, but more of a leader as to people follow him, as to what he was doing, and I think people are following him. Now I think that when he gets out or when the opportunity comes, that he'll continue to be a positive and productive person when he's released back into society. This is going to be his parole to his next consecutive sentence, and that is the step toward him being able to get parole to go back out on the street and be able to. He was involved in some things as a teenager, and he got caught up in an atmosphere that was not productive to him, and I think he's learned from that, and that not only do I think he probably will be a productive person once he gets out, although, like I said, we're still going to the next consecutive sentence, but I think that he's managed to be an influence to, you know, to his family, to his nieces, and nephew. Sometimes, you know, you can be an influence and not really know it, you know, when his nieces and nephews and rest of the family go back and see, you know, one simple mistake has cost him all of his, you know, adult life. You know, since he's been an adult, he's been incarcerated. But for all of his adult life, how one simple act of judgment could do it. Sometimes that does have an influence on, you know, what the kids think of coming up with, because they too have the opportunity to see it and then have the opportunity to speak with him at some point and see it. I think that at this point in time, Mr. Baldonado has definitely made that change, and I'm very supportive of him being paroled to his next consecutive sentence, and actually look forward to him coming back to this board to see what his progress has been, to see about him possibly getting home arrest.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Any further discussion from fellow board members? Okay, I'm getting close to making a motion. I want to follow up again by saying, as I stated at the beginning, I think there was a wisdom in monitoring Mr. Baldonado's progress since his first parole eligibility, and I'm very impressed with what he's done with his time the last year, especially in regards to the cognitive behavioral therapy. My colleague and I may not agree 100% about juvenile brain development. Frankly, I actually agree with what he said because I do believe it's in context. But I will say that I am a big fan of cognitive behavioral therapy, period. So I'm going to go ahead and make a motion, and we'll see how the board votes. And that motion is to grant Mr. Joseph Baldonado, ADC number 092563, parole to his next consecutive sentence, but deny absolute discharge. And that is my motion.
Second.
Agreed.
Seconded by Mr. Neal.
Agreed.
Agreed by Mr. Johnson. And agreed upon by Ms. Rittenhouse. Again, I want to make sure that I check the right boxes, and that is release type granted is 412D. Parole to his next consecutive sentence. Release type denied, absolute discharge. And we have a few extra boxes for conditions of release, and that is not release, but to parole to his next, pardon me, to his next consecutive sentence, and that is simply abide by institutional rules as he has to continue to navigate his way through his final sentence before considering regular parole. Partake in available programming, and as he stated earlier, not everything is available to him in Browning, but certainly he's done quite a job of pursuing programming, and I want to commend him for that. And of course, refrain from disciplinary infractions. And I don't think there's anything else to add, but I'll ask my fellow board members if I missed anything. Okay, Mr. Baldonado, you heard our discussion. The vote was unanimous to grant you parole to your next consecutive sentence, but to deny absolute discharge. Is there anything else? I'm sorry. Pardon me. Is there anything you would like to say before we end this hearing?
I'd just like to appreciate it and thanks the board for having faith in me and noticing the change and the transformation that you know, I've become a different person from a youngster and today. And just, I will not let you down, and I'll continue doing what I'm doing until my next parole hearing, and hopefully when time comes, I'm on release.
Well, thank you, sir. Please stay safe. And I don't know who will be sitting on this board the next time you're up for parole eligibility, but we do wish you the best. And this will bring our hearing to a close.